Welcome to the weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Matt.
Hey, Matt, how's it going? With me this week is Matt. Very cool. And this week on the weekly, Brick Wars, published by Modiphius, BattleTech Essentials, US only, Rainbow Six Siege is your wallet, and not just your game table, and Star Wars Unlimited trading card game. And then Rebellion acquires the rights to Tunnels and Trolls. So, yeah, quite a variety of stuff going on. And, everything, this kind of touches on everything that's been going on in the industry in general. So let's start with Brick Wars. So this was really surprising. Modiphius was promoting, they're probably just the distributor, you know, helping them get things published and distributing Brick Wars. So that's Brick, B-R-I-K, no C, Wars, one word. And it's basically Warhammer, like it's 40K in Legos. And I guess in the 90s, there was a big kind of homebrew movement of using Legos to play 40K. And this was one of the survivors. So this was legally distinct enough as a clone of, the homebrew stuff that people were writing and also of the, you know, Games Workshop setting that they were able to continued development. So about 25 years ago, kind of war game Lego Wars first came out and inspired a lot of people to try to do war games with Lego pieces and Lego minis. And they were cease and desisted into oblivion. Of course, if you've got the Lego group and Games Workshop after you, I don't think you're going to get very far. But Mike Rayhawks created Brick Wars. So in 95, it was distinct enough from the previous kind of parody versions of 40K that people were doing, like Lego Wars, that it survived legally. And it had its first definitive version in 1997. So after a number of revisions, it's finally coming out with this latest rule set. Or I guess there was a rule set in the latest rule set was in 2020, and this is going to be the first time that it will be available in print. So previous to that, it was a printable PDF of an ever-changing rule set, and basically they solidified the rules, and then publisher Modiphius is going to release it. So it's the absolutely definitely and definitive edition of Brick Wars. So did you see anything about this, Matt, or the cover of the book?
I saw a little blurb. One of the guys in our gaming group is a Lego fanatic. Kind of person that, like, you know, I saw a link that Brick Fest was coming to our town. And so I sent it to him and he immediately sent back, "Oh, that's the fake one." You know, like he's on that level.
Right. The posers, the Brick posers, yeah.
Right. But I have two questions. One is, like, how it must be really far removed from looking like 40K.
Right.
To Modiphius is convinced they're not going to get sued for this.
Yes.
So, I mean, does it still kind of look like 40K?
Not really. It has kind of the similar roles. Like there's the technology and but it's a lot more like wacky mashup and gonzo, I think, in the way they want you to be able to, in the rule set, play any Lego mini you want. So you can basically have Wolverine and Dragon Ball Z and Harry Potter or whatever you want to mash together.
It's more of a universal.
It's more like the setting is a kind of, I think, grimdark war, but they let you include a lot of crazy stuff so you can push it whichever way you want. And they don't name anything that kind of overlaps with any of the factions or anything. I didn't see, like, you know, references to Space Marines or anything. So there.
My second question is, do they, did you know on the Lego website you can actually design stuff and it'll give you the how many bricks, you know, all the parts you need, basically, mm-hmm. and then you can order them?
Yes.
Do they provide you with the information to do that, or is it all on you to?
I think it's all on you. Yeah, it's basically they give you rules to how to stat out anything you'd want to design for the game, but yeah, they are leaving it like you get to kind of come up with how you're building things. Yeah, so I don't think there's rules. It might be, I don't even know if there's base sizes or anything, but they have a Brick Wars My Own Creation rule system. So you can define gameplay attributes for anything you can build out of your Legos or any minifigures you might have. So, Yeah, so it's interesting. The only problem is, like, switching to Lego, and maybe that's why this is the only surviving version of this. Switching to Lego doesn't save you any money. Legos are insanely expensive. I mean, you may have them around, but if you're going to buy Legos to build an army, it's not any cheaper than playing actual 40K. So it's not like you're getting any relief. You just have, like, more creative freedom, I guess, to mess
it's
with
so,
stuff.
It's so expensive that, like, people sell 3D printed Lego figures. You know, they look like Legos, mm-hmm. but they're just, you know, they're 3D printed because assembling them the real way is more expensive.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's very true. And there's a lot of knockoff Legos, like, yeah, a lot of, you know, Chinese counterfeit Legos and stuff. So who knows how they even, you know, snap together. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. But so this new edition is the revamped rules, and this came out of kind of the community. So this is a lot of community contribution. So a couple of things that they talk about is a game's toy box like kind of playfulness, and they encourage players to actually break the rules. So they apply the law of fudge to maximize fun and not like rules lawyering and stuff. So that's a huge legal distinction from 40K, because 40K is all about lawyering those rules. So this is just, you know, fudge it and enjoy the goofiness of it. So a quote from Ray Hawk, I created Brick Wars to celebrate the timeless joy of kids smashing construction toys together. And for the past 20 years, I've had the thrill of watching the community take it in directions infinitely more creative and epic and over the top than I'd ever imagined. So this updated edition is built on the rubble of many generations of plastic empires and thousands of minifig casualties. I'm forever excited to see players create and discover all kinds of never-before-seen creative masterpieces for their minifigs to smash to plastic bits. So yeah, it sounds like their heart is in the right place, definitely. With
my son was young, he would play the Lego. You know, Lego put out that series of board games.
Oh yeah, right.
He would build the board, and I think the one he liked the most was, there was like a labyrinth, a Minotaur labyrinth one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd roll and your guys would move around, the Minotaur would eat you.
Right, right.
The whole time that we were playing that, because it also had buildable dice, so you could pull off the faces.
Uh-huh.
Nice. And like, you know, our friend Will was playing with us, and all he loves making up games, and all he can think is, you know, they should just sell those dice so you can design your own games with them and stuff. And
yeah, definitely.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea. Very nice. So the rules include the details for building the minifig specialists in the game, engineering mechanics with a K, and also everyday civilians. So there's a book with an armory and abilities. So they kind of, you know, set up things you can do, and you just, you know, design the stuff that can do it. So a nuclear catapult, a chainsaw, or just a brick. You could just have your character use a brick as a weapon. A Lego brick, that would be. Nice. So it's D6 or D10, depending on the rules, and very straightforward. So you have a move action, then you can perform a separate action, which is either an attack or a special ability. And combat tests are very simple, and you're rolling against armor value, taking damage, which either defeats or reduces abilities of the target. So very fun. And they also have kind of campaign rules. So the heroic escapades are for playing matches of an ongoing campaign. And so we're going to see Brick Wars, and it's got a really crazy cover of just kind of a mashup of every kind of Lego bit you can imagine. But nothing, I think, you know, no licensed IP stuff, but it'll hit retail. The physical book will hit retail later this year from Modiphius. So yeah, the cover is a colorful battle with Cthulhu, a flaming teddy bear, an army of Lego minifigurines, and a flame spewing Hydra. So yeah, lots of creative stuff.
Did Lego make any sets that had orcs in them?
Lord of the Rings has a lot of, and they, I think they did it. Yeah, Lord of the Rings. They've done a couple of generic orcs in their minifigure series. There was one that looked very Warcraft. There was a very Warcraft looking orc, and but I think most of them are from the Lord of the Rings sets. Yeah. Yeah, we did. That was the thing. Our first Frostgrave campaign was Lego minifig stuff. So yeah, we were building our gangs out of minifigs, which was fun. But it's not cheap. It's definitely it's about the same. You're not painting anything, but you're paying for every little bit that you want on there.
Yep.
But yeah. So another game, or a game that is trying to get some new players in on it, is BattleTech. So it was just announced BattleTech. So after that huge successful campaign for Mercenaries, BattleTech Essentials is coming to Target only. So Catalyst Labs is going to release, and this looks like a very, very entry point, kind of what Games Workshop was doing with some of their board games. I think they were Barnes & Noble's exclusive kind of things, where they were doing colored plastic with some simple tile-based board games to try to get you acquainted with the setting for 40K. This is going to be a very, very stripped down version of BattleTech with two mechs, a hex grid map to play on, some tokens, dice, and a rule book and cards. So very, like, as far as components, compared to their beginner box or anything else, pretty minimal. But the setting is a little bit different as well. So you're playing Solaris 7, and this isn't a combat mission or anything. It's actually a combat arena. So this is entertainment. You're on television. You're being televised, and you're seeking probably prize money and victory as entertainment. So the two mechs go against each other, and the ones that are included are the Legend Killer and Yen Lo Wang models are included, and they give you quick start rules. And I wonder how complete those rules are, because it's it might just be kind of introductory rules. So two unpainted pre-assembled miniatures, a punch board with some terrain and any additional pieces, a double-sided map, a little bit of an instant guide to the inner sphere. Oh, and actually, yeah, and fiction too. That's cool. So a 24-page novella, four record sheets, four mech cards, and the Solaris Arena map rules sheet. So all of that is $24.95 is the suggested retail. So that's less than half of the previous boxes. So it doesn't contain as much, but you know, it's a way to get you a way to learn the rules, get a couple of models, and actually be able to play. So a very affordable entry point, and it may, you know, get discounted even more, you know, online or whatever from Target.
So I bought, I played BattleTech in the whole, like, late 80s, early 90s, and then maybe, let's say 10, 15 years ago, I bought one of their starter sets. Mm-hmm. This was after Catalyst took over.
Oh, okay.
And all the rules were there for the standard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what really annoyed me was they had all these like sort of advanced or alternative weapon systems and things listed on the equipment lists and everything, because building a custom mech is one of the funnest parts of BattleTech, in my opinion. But they didn't have any of the rules to explain any of that stuff.
Oh, wow.
And it was so annoying, because, like, I'm trying to teach people and they're like, well, what does this one do? And it's like, well, we don't have the rules for that one.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So
yeah.
We'll just ignore that. So I hope they didn't do anything like that in this one. They probably didn't. Sounds like it's super light.
Yeah, it looks like it.
I'm a little surprised they didn't go with two classic mechs.
Yeah.
Yes, if it's to get new people, they don't care about that.
Yeah, and maybe they want the collectors too to buy this set. You know, they want people to buy the set that are just huge BattleTech fans. You know, the kind of collectors or completionists that want to have, like, everything they've ever produced. Yeah, yeah, interesting. Yeah, so that's 1,900 stores in the U.S. or on Target.com. So we may have to connect with Miguel and give my daughter a call and see if she can head over to Target. and pick up a couple of copies. Yeah, so and that's so that might be pretty popular online as well. I'm sure eBay will be full of BattleTech essentials for the international market. Yeah, because if they're so obviously not going to market this outside, so this product will not appear on the Catalyst Labs website either. So it's exclusive to Target stores.
It really is.
Yeah. So they're not gonna break.
So any of that. The latest version, do you know? Because I wasn't paying enough attention. Maybe Miguel can tell us.
Mm-hmm.
Did they revamp the rules at all, or did they just new edition? Here we go.
Yeah,
cleaned it up.
From what I've heard, that's still compatible. Like I don't think the rule system has changed much. They did do, and I'm forgetting what it's called, but they did a simplified rule set previously to get people to try the game without like heat rules and things like heat distribution, and so they did a simplified a rule set to get people to try it, but I don't know what the biggest difference is between the new and old.
If someone tried to play BattleTech with me and they didn't track heat, I would just get up and walk away.
right. Yeah, I forget what that's called. There's like a assault mode or something where it's just you're just shooting, you're just running and shooting. They take away
baby mode.
right. Yeah. But I guess for younger players and stuff too. And at least maybe like a if that's your first game and you like, you know, how the strategy works, then to go deeper into, you know, how the mechs themselves, the mechanics of actually running that, so taking the damage but also distributing the heat might draw people in. I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm curious what this will do. But yeah, after the huge success that they've had, it's funny they're doing a retail release so quickly. I put a link to the video. There's a little introduction video to kind of describe the what this setting is, and there's a little bit on the back of the box. The arenas of Solaris 7 have seen glory and defeat, honor and treachery, blood and money. Now it's your turn to make a name for yourself on the game world with an all-new BattleTech boxed set, BattleTech Essentials. So yeah, a little bit of kind of, and maybe that's another thing they're trying to do is not hit you too heavy with the lore, because that's a little bit of what's keeping me from diving too deep, is I need to familiarize myself with the lore before I like want to be painting models and things and kind of choosing factions. And I don't seem like I know enough. So in this Essentials set, you're basically, you know, you've got a choice of two mechs and you don't have to immerse yourself into when in the timeline is this going on? Who is this? Yeah. Yeah. So it's a good approach, I think, to keep people from getting crippled, you know, paralyzed by the huge amount of choice that you have in the game, you know, of what you want to build and what you want to do. So, yeah, keeping it very restricted. So that should be, it's available for pre-order now, and the release date is soon. June 18th is the shipping date. So Target will see people waiting in line for the cases to be opened or maybe taken straight from the loading docks. So so a Target exclusive. It's probably a good deal for them. They probably get a much better price by making it exclusive to Target. The deal must be good, but it's a little odd because Target isn't everywhere and it's not outside the U.S. So yeah, interesting move. So
I'm always surprised by what board games show up in a Target though. Like mm-hmm. when I wander by their board game section, you know. They've really expanded that. It always surprises me.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's not just Operation and Monopoly anymore. Yeah, it's it goes beyond. Yeah,
Pandemic the one that cracked them. Like, I think Pandemic was a big one that they were like, okay, we'll try some of these nerd games and see how it goes.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That makes sense because. Yeah, aside from bookstores, and with bookstores disappearing, like the chain bookstores disappearing, yeah, where else would you get stuff? Yeah, that's true. I wonder how much role play, like tabletop role play stuff they carry, like if they have much 5e. I'm sure they would have the boxes, right? They probably have like the starter
they have,
sets.
Like, the 5e starter set.
Mm-hmm.
I think like a set of D&D branded dice.
Oh.
but pretty much that's it.
Okay. Interesting.
They sell all those villainous games.
Right, right.
But they sell, like, surprising, like... oh, of course, I'm blanking now. Like, they sell Pandemic Legacy.
Oh, wow. Seems
kind of weird.
Yeah, yeah.
And, those other ones, other, like, niche... What I would think of were as more niche board games mm-hmm. are there. They sell Catan, big surprise. Mm-hmm. But, there's those ones now, a lot of those, the movie branded ones.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Jaws one, which is a really good game, by the way. Mm-hmm. They sell that one. They sell like the Shining one. I'm blanking. But yeah, there's a whole series. I think most of them are by Ravensburger, but mm-hmm. or Aaliyah, which I think owns Ravensburger, or mm-hmm. the other way around. Anyway. Kind of like that They Live game that's on Kickstarter right
yeah,
now.
Right,
those
right.
kind of thing. Oh, The Thing. That was the other one. The Thing.
Oh, right, right. Interesting. Yeah, that would make sense. They'd go into like licensed, you know, IP games, so they're very recognizable on the shelf. So even if you don't, you know, you don't know the game, you'll know the setting or whatever, so that you might pick it up based on what, you know, either of those things.
Were selling... The segue into one of your future stories.
Oh, yes, yes.
They were selling Star Wars Destiny for a while.
Too. Oh, interesting. Yeah. I wondered if Fantasy Flight, like if they made it into kind of big box retailers. Yeah. Because now that they're, now they've been absorbed by the larger company. Yeah. Interesting. Wow. Well, speaking of board games and paying too much for board games, that has to be a thing too, that when they go into the big box stores, they have to probably have a price threshold. They're not going to sell like $150 board games, so they're going to have to be, you know, probably around $50 for people to even look at them at a Target or Walmart or whatever. But a board game that is asking for you to pay again to actually see it completed is the Rainbow Six Siege, the board game. So Mythic Games, again, has overextended themselves. And I think this is the danger of these licensed IP games. They've been really going heavy into doing licensed IPs. And they ran into a little trouble with Rainbow Six. This is not the first time. Previously, their Darkest Dungeon game, I believe, I think we talked about that a year or two ago, had some problems where they had to go back to the people that pledged on the Kickstarter and say, we can't finish this game. We need to ask you for more money. If you don't give us more money, we can't. We're going to have to cancel the campaign. But they were able to... get the additional funds and we're able to complete that game. So they're at it again. So they're asking backers to pay an extra fee for the game's unexpectedly pricey production. And the problems that they're saying they're having is, of course, the unanticipated crisis of COVID and war in Ukraine have made it difficult. Mythic is based in France, right? They're an EU based company. So yeah, they might have more direct problems with the proximity to that conflict. So a quote from Mythic, the estimates on which we based ourselves before and during the Kickstarter campaign are absolutely no longer relative. So they're giving backers 2 weeks to decide if they're willing to pay this extra fee. And the fee is kind of broken down between how much you pledge, like the different pledge levels. So if everything goes as planned and they get the additional funding, they should fulfill by August 2023. The funds received for this contribution will entirely and exclusively be reserved for printing Six Siege, the board game, the Rainbow Six, yeah, the Rainbow Six board game. But if people are unwilling to pay, then you will not receive your game in October. So yeah, basically they need a certain number of people to pledge, and if it doesn't work out, then they're not going to go through with it. So based on what pledge level you backed, if you were at the $69 level, they're asking for an additional $39, $199, they're asking for another $99, and if you went all in at $269, be prepared to give them an additional $129.
Oh.
So you're almost...
Yeah. Everything I said earlier about people being annoying on Kickstarter and complaining about shit, doesn't count for this because this is a whole nother thing.
It really is. Yeah. So if you really want to play Rainbow Six, you're going to be paying about $400 for the total experience. Whew. But to kind of sweeten the deal, they're going to add extra maps and STL files for the miniatures as a way of apologizing. So I don't. Yeah, I guess that helps. They had a so their previous campaign that they had to do this with, Darkest Dungeon, they had 80% of the backers pay the extra fee, which enabled them to produce the game. So if they don't hit the level that they need to finish production, people will get their contributions back. I don't know if that means everything, their initial pledges and everything, but if you commit to this extra money and it doesn't happen, you'll definitely get that back. I'm not sure what else is being refunded. They also said, we spent much more than expected in development of the game, with more people than expected working on it, and much longer than we originally estimated. So they have a laundry list of reasons now. It's more employees, longer development time, the war in Ukraine, you know, everything is adding to the list. This didn't come out of nowhere, though. The backers were warned as early as March in a March update that this would be happening, giving them time to kind of make the decision. The managing director of Mythic Games said, "We know it's a difficult situation to accept. We understand a lot of anger or disappointment, but we've been very clear and simply offered a clear choice to make. We want to do everything we can to deliver this game to you, to the motivated backers who will take the plunge, rather than playing it low-key and avoiding making noise." Well, it's good. I mean, it's good that they're not. I mean, but they have a reputation and they have, you know, projects in process and future crowdfunding. So, of course, they can't just go radio silent and hope for the best. We never got our games. But yeah, so I think that kind of golden age that we had of these crazy, you know, big Kickstarters for these big Ameritrash, like, you know, so many plastic minis, you know, huge amounts of cardboard. Board games might be coming to an end just because they're getting prohibitively expensive. I mean, people are not going to want to pay $400 to play a complete experience of a board game.
So this is another situation where I would love to see the licensing contract that they have. Who's Rainbow Six? Is that like EA? Or?
I think so, yeah. I think that's the Tom Clancy EA stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see that contract. Mm-hmm. Did they just give them a bunch of money at the beginning?
Mm.
Are they promising them a percentage of revenue?
Right.
Is there an ongoing like payment plan? Like, I would love to know the structure.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's anything where EA or whoever it is expecting money down the line, oh boy.
Yeah.
Dangerous.
Well, no, that's very true. Yeah. Yeah. And, if they keep running into this, I think it's going to make people more and more cautious. I didn't look at the total numbers, but I wonder if the, you know, the total collected for these campaigns is slowly decreasing because people are becoming a little more, you know, wary of this kind of thing happening again. Yeah, it's got to be. I don't know. This whole model is a little strange. I mean, it's made things possible that would have never, you know, been a reality before, been possible to be published or become a physical game. It's helped a lot of those things happen, but some companies, I think, have become very addicted to this kind of treadmill of, okay, we'll raise $2 million for this, and then we'll use it to fund this. And so they're paying for stuff with new money that it was, you know, that needed. It's very, very difficult to kind of get off that. Yeah.
Kickstarter should have a cooling off period where, like,
yeah, right.
if your Kickstarter hits this amount of money, you cannot do another Kickstarter for a year.
Right.
You know, I don't, some kind of cooling off period. Because it's just bad money management, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's just unrealistic, over promising, under delivering. Sorry, France, this is why your president wants you all to retire a year later. Yeah. Because you're bad with money.
Right. Yeah, but I think that's very true, because you do get companies that they haven't fulfilled a previous crowdfunding campaign, and they're starting another one, and they're asking for more money. You've already given them $100, and they're like, oh, how about another $100 for this other game that we're going to be working on? We haven't finished the previous one, but we really want to do that. So, yeah. I don't know. It's a little tricky, and I think the system may eventually break down. And, you know, companies like Hasbro are just doing this themselves. They're moving this whole idea completely onto their own websites and you know, trying to crowdfund Star Wars, you know, lightsaber toys and stuff. So,
but then that becomes a problem too, because, like, I was thinking about that the other day. This Hasbro, and it ties into what we were saying earlier about Target, like, whatever Hasbro does in their lab thing is they don't then turn that into a line that they produce, right?
Right. So
it doesn't end up going into Target or Walmart or whatever.
No, that's true. Yeah.
So it's built in niche, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. I guess if Kickstarter had that, like, if you were like, okay, look, you need to have small goals and small, like, don't plan for this to become this giant life-changing event. keep it more like cottage industry, mm-hmm, like small, mm-hmm. But they don't, because Kickstarter just wants their money.
So. Yeah. 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 They're loving it that they're getting these multi-million dollar campaigns because they get 10% of that. So yeah, they, with just a little bit of promotion and running a website. Yeah. Kickstarter cleans up on these big and I think that's the problem, because the power of Kickstarter is enabling small individual creators to actually get stuff to their fans directly and have people support you directly and have the ability to work with these companies to do distribution and publishing or, you know, printing that you never would have before. But then when the big guys come in with a lot of money and these big licensed IPs and stuff, it was good though. That was the thing that was a little bit reassuring. Speaking about the Alchemy virtual tabletop that you mentioned before, there are obviously companies, licenses like Alien and Blade Runner, that are telling these companies, yeah, we don't want our name, our IP in a crowdfunding campaign. That's, you know, that's a step below us. And I think that some companies should be considering that. They shouldn't so easily take stuff to crowdfunding. But I think it's going to be even, unfortunately, it's not going to work as well, but it's going to be more necessary because of all this unexpected, cost of actually shipping things out and production. If that becomes more and more unpredictable, then you're going to have to rely on crowdfunding, because you don't want to take those risks without it. You know, you don't want that. You won't have any money in advance. You're going to go into this, you're putting your company at risk going into this gambling, and the cost can be, you know, much bigger than you ever expected and completely can, you know, bankrupt your company. Whereas Kickstarter will at least give you a buffer. You don't have to commit to anything before you've got customers, you know, handing their fistful of cash, you know, to you. So we'll see. What happens in the future. But it's just a shame that it's not, it doesn't exclusively, they try. I mean, they obviously with the, RPG, you know, kind of jam stuff, or like the campaigns they do to support small zine type publishers and stuff. They do support smaller creators, but they love those multi-million dollar campaigns now.
Have you backed anything on the, what's it called? It's the one that used to be just a promoter of Kickstarters, and then they started doing their own.
Oh, like GameFound?
Yeah,
I think so.
Have you backed anything on there?
I backed, I think on both, because there's two of them that are competing now that were both back ends. I think I've backed on both of them, and I don't think, it hasn't been long enough. Nothing's fulfilled yet, but they're really good with updates. You almost get too many updates, because even stuff that you didn't back, they send you updates for. Just if you, like, were interested in it or signed up to be, you know, notified about the launch of it, they act like you're a backer. So it's a little bit confusing, because you're getting updates for things you didn't pledge on. And so you're like, wait a minute, did I buy this game? But I think they're doing that as a trick, because at any time you can still jump into the late pledge. Like they keep things open, even though it's a time limited campaign, until it actually goes to production, they're still taking pledges. So they'll send you, they'll send you updates just to hope that you'll, jump in at a later date. Yes.
That's funny too. So like, if you have a campaign and it has an end date, you should be getting all that stuff straight with your production company in China or whatever, and getting all your stuff set with your distribution company. But then if you're going to take these late pledges somewhere, that's going to mess up your books.
I would assume. Right. Yeah, maybe they just have like they you know overproduced to a certain extent to just allow for that, and they would love if that stuff got pre-sold as well. So yeah, it's hard to know because it seems like recently too, so many Kickstarters are just saying this will never go to retail, even though there are some online retailers that do take overstock of Kickstarter, especially Come On games and stuff. So when Come On says it's not going to retail, they're usually lying because online retail, I guess they don't consider that a thing. But that's been a thing recently. So speaking of companies we no longer trust and are skeptical of.
That's a long list.
Yeah. Let's move on to Fantasy Flight. So Fantasy Flight, yes. I used to really like, you know, their Arkham World or whatever they call it. They're kind of Lovecraft stuff. And I liked a lot of stuff that early Fantasy Flight did, but they have really, really made it hard to like them with their long list of kind of failures and projects that just, you know, fell apart for no good reason. Mm-hmm. So the next one on that list will be Star Wars Unlimited, the trading card game. And they're calling it a non-gimmicky trading card game. So I'm a little confused about this terminology now because Fantasy Flight coined the living card game, that the kind of their thing that they created was a living card game that did not have random packs, that had they named it different things for their different games, but it basically had card packs that were released that were all the same. So they would come out and everybody would buy these, you know, small decks, and they would be the exact same cards, and they would add mechanics to the game, and everyone had access to them. It wasn't the person that bought a case of the cards or bought the luckiest pack that got the best cards. So it became more deck building and skill based that allowed these cards to work within the game. But it did create this weird treadmill where the meta was kind of driven by these releases, and it was predictable what cards were coming out. So you had to get these cards and kind of be ready for the meta to shift with this availability. A bit different from Magic, which involves a huge investment to kind of make sure you have all the best cards. So the confusion is there's trading card games, TCGs, and there's CCGs, collectible card games. So what are these going to be, random packs? There's nothing in their press release right now that is saying if these are coming as randomized packs or these are decks you buy and everybody gets the same. They're being a little bit unclear about how these games will be presented, if they'll be completed decks or you're buying card packs. Yeah, it's a little odd.
My reading of it. Well, okay. First of all, when I read that press release, and when they said not gimmicky, I kind of thought maybe they were referring to Destiny.
Ah.
Because Destiny had the dice.
Right.
Which, for whatever reason, some Magic players and Pokemon players, whatever, that like broke their brains a little bit. But
right.
It was a little bit of a hassle having to collect these huge collections of dice to go with these big collections of cards. Living card games, not as efficient as they wanted everyone to think.
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah.
Because the rules normally always were you could run three of a card in your deck in the Fantasy Flight living card games. Well, when you bought the living card box, which I think in some instances you could subscribe to them, you got one of each of those new cards.
Right.
So really you had to buy three of those sets
to get
enough to make it playable in a competitive deck. So yeah, not as charitable as they wanted everyone to think it was.
Oh, yeah. Their core sets, their starter sets, to really be in, because I got into Netrunner a little bit late, and basically they said you need need to buy three core sets to have three of each of the cards to be to even start out at a basic level of having competitive decks. So yeah, that's a really shady business model. And the things that they've been doing too with some of their other like model-based games like X-Wing and stuff is they're basically forcing you to buy everything they release regardless of the faction or whatever, because there'll be faction neutral cards in there that will be mm-hmm. useful for you. So they just want you to buy everything and not without any question. And I think even Games Workshop has picked up a little bit on that kind of bad business model of just wanting you to buy everything just in case. Yeah, just in case we've included something useful. So Unlimited will launch in 2024 with a full 200-plus card set. So this is all new art based on the original trilogy, which from the promotional work looks terrible, I'm sorry to say, but there's a lot of great digital painted art out there. And this looked like coloring book, traced coloring books from the 70s. It looked really, really weak as far as, old school original trilogy art. And they're also going to do a full slate of organized play events. So right away, they want this to be an organized competitive game. So Jim Cartwright is the co-designer of this game and acknowledges that they're fighting an uphill battle to earn the hearts of potential players who were burned by previous experiences of Fantasy Flight franchises. And so basically every card game, and there's some on the shelves behind me, games that they literally have just abandoned. They either lost the license or just gave up development of a game and never completed it. So especially for like a living card game, you could actually come to like an end point where you say, okay, we're not adding any more mechanics. This is the game. This is the card pool, and it will be playable forever. They've never done that. They've never finished a game. They just kind of, dwindle because of, I think of how they design and produce. They never can get to the point. It's kind of like, a sitcom or whatever that's canceled mid-season and you never get any resolution on any of the characters, the stories. A lot of their card games have done that thing where they're just this unplayable, they just dwindle into nothing and have underdeveloped mechanics and weird overpowered cards that come out at the end and just kind of, blow things up. But so a few of their failures in the past, of course, have been Netrunner, where they lost the license for the game, I guess, which was originally WotC's, and Legend of the Five Rings, and of course, Matt named Star Wars Destiny, the dice card game. So the other weird thing that's happened to them recently was Keyforge. So Keyforge was this another Richard Garfield game that had this interesting mechanic where based on an algorithm, they pre-built decks, and you would have these decks that were just kind of randomly made, but around a couple of factions or whatever. They had a system that they were making these decks. So you didn't do any deck building. You just bought a deck and played it. And based on whatever factions were in it, it would have a certain dynamic. But a mysterious technical mishap with their algorithm forced them to just stop production on the game, say that they were going to resume production someday and never did. And then eventually a totally different company, which I think is owned by one of the creators, or one of the directors of Keyforge, is now trying to produce the game. They're trying to repair what got broken and are producing it independently from Fantasy Flight. So they haven't had a great track record with card games. And so this is a bit odd. And the timing of this is, especially because it's original trilogy, it's just kind of strange because nothing Star Wars is making anybody very excited recently. So another quote from Fantasy Flight, this is a game in which we have dedicated more resources than any other game in Fantasy Flight games history, Cartwright says. In the past, these kinds of games, we had a difficulty hitting those kind of regular cadences, release cadences. Anyone who played a Fantasy Flight game knows this. It's something that we've struggled with, and we are committed to putting games out on time. It's the way the industry works. If you want to do a trading card game, you have to be able to be committed to hit those dates. And with how unreliable Chinese production is and supply chain is, I don't know why they think suddenly now they can do this. So Yeah, they and another quote by Cartwright, we're not trying to get into anything crazy or fancy. We just want to focus all our design on how do we make the best card game, specifically focus on the cards, focus on the interactions with those cards, and the kind of unlimited possibilities you get from being able to play with all of your Star Wars toys. It is a non-gimmicky trading card game. So
okay. There's so many opinions right now. What did they say? I don't remember. Did they say in the press release or an estimated release date?
They just said next year. Yeah, it's going to be beginning of next year. Yeah, 2024.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's my prediction. Lock it in. Uh-huh. Just pay attention.
Okay.
2026, the line will be over.
Yes, I agree. I definitely would agree.
So two biggies that weren't on your list. The Genesis role-playing game.
Oh yeah, yeah.
They took their Star Wars game, which was actually quite beloved by a lot of people, modified the system, made it a universal sort of RPG system.
Right.
Got a lot of kudos for it, even though I personally don't like it. Got a lot of kudos for it, and they dropped it. Get out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
Bigger than that, even is they shot themselves in the foot. Pissed off Games Workshop and lost all their Games Workshop stuff.
Yes, that's right.
Like, yeah, I have what's the big 40K board game called? Oh,
the Horus Heresy. The
Battlefleet. No.
Oh, Relic. The big.
It's like Twilight Imperium, but 40K, and I'm blanking on what it's called right now.
Oh, okay.
It's a really good game.
Yeah, it takes
8 hours of play. But it's a really good game.
Nice.
And I have that in a treasured corner, you know, like protect this at all costs because it will never be allowed to be made again.
Oh, nice.
Not Space Hulk Abyss, but thank you. Anyway, they pissed off Games Workshop because they wanted to put out their own rank and file miniature battle games.
Yes, right.
And they lost their Games Workshop shit.
Right.
And they're not really doing that great in the war game area.
Yeah, not at all. Right.
So, like, this will fail. Because the other reason it's going to fail is because possibly the only thing that's going to sell enough to stay alive coming out is that Lorcana, the Disney TCG.
Right.
Nobody between Magic, Pokemon, and Lorcana, they're not going to get any numbers on sales for this thing.
Right. No, that's very
true. They're going to get a small, Star Wars diehard who buy everything Star Wars. And maybe a little experimentation from people that loved Destiny, because Destiny also was a lot of fun. But then it's just going to all... It's not going to compete. It's going to die. They're going to kill it. It's like, don't waste your money.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's like it's not worth committing to. And I think if they're anticipating like a competitive scene or competitive events to keep this going, and also a secondary market, Magic has for reselling valuable cards and things, I think that's insane because that's already dominated by Magic and Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh and all that stuff. Yeah. So Ravensburger's Disney Lorcana, I think, is going to totally destroy anything.
I'm going to buy it just because I want the little Fox Robin Hood from my childhood card.
right. Yes. Yeah, so this is a really weird thing. And I noticed in one of the comments under this announcement, somebody said, wait a minute, you guys just released a Star Wars card game. So in March of this year, they released Star Wars the deck building game. So a head-to-head two-player galaxy-expanding war between Galactic Empire and Rebel Alliance comes alive on your tabletop. And I think it's like a pre-built deck, like a light deck and a dark deck. And it's a deck building, whereas like you're picking up cards as part of the gameplay, like you're buying cards during rounds.
I'm pretty sure all the assets for that are just scavenged from the Star Wars card game they tried and failed with.
Right.
Before Destiny, they had another one. They had another Star Wars living card game that failed. Yeah. And they did Destiny. And then they put out that box that you're talking about. And I think the assets in that box are all taken from that old card game.
Wow. Yeah, so... It's really strange, and they're already creating such, you know, brand confusion, because if they're going to have so many things, you know, Star Wars, are we going to have so many licensed Star Wars card games, people are not going to know, okay, is this the new one or not? Yeah, it's very strange. Yeah, I just don't think they've figured anything out. Oh, and a funny thing, they released a statement back when KeyForge had its little glitch. They released a statement that talked about the unforeseen complication in the algorithm for KeyForge. It's broken and it needs to be rebuilt from the ground up. This is neither an easy process nor a fast one. So that is why the game is going on hiatus for a while. And it never came back from that hiatus. But yeah, they don't have luck. I think they have their production processes and their, like, I think the owner, I heard a quote like years ago of him saying, like, at any one time they have 2,000 print jobs active in China for their games. And this was like more at their height when they were, you know, had all their licenses and everything. But
that was, now they got bought by Asmodee.
Yes, you're right.
And then Asmodee got bought by Embracer Group.
Oh, right. That's right.
I haven't talked about them in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And nothing's, I don't, to me, it doesn't seem like anything's changed. Same old bad management at Fantasy
Flight. Yeah. Like, yeah, I think they mistakenly left, yeah, the same people in charge, and they're just, yeah, they're making these same bad decisions, and in a world that's even more difficult to, you know, to pull this kind of stuff off. So yeah, it's very strange. So another failed Star Wars game, and it's just, Star Wars could not be at a lower ebb in popularity right now as far as like people just giving up on that brand. So I don't know. We will see what actually.
Did you see that? This is a tangent. Mm-hmm. So did you see that the interview with what's her name, Kathleen Kennedy?
Oh,
about the future titles and stuff.
Oh no! I saw their little press thing they did when they announced the Ahsoka series and stuff. Oh, and the new Rey movie possibly.
Yeah, yeah. So they claim that the Rogue Squadron movie is still on the books.
Oh, uh huh.
And she said that, what was the other one? Oh, she said Taika Waititi's movie is still happening, but he has two good acts. So basically she's saying he's not even done writing the thing.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
What else did they say? Oh, they said there's a Lando project that might still be on the books. Something. Oh, yeah, yeah. They asked about Rian Johnson. Remember how Rian Johnson was supposed to do a trilogy?
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. And she said, oh, I talk to him every day. But he's a very busy man. I'm like, what the does that mean?
Oh, man. Yeah, I can't even imagine. Maybe he's subverting our expectations by taking a trilogy and making it zero films. Like, now a trilogy means no films at all. Yeah. Dude, you're blowing our minds.
Worst space chase in science fiction history.
Yes, anyway, yes, right. Yes. I love the introduction of space gas. That's awesome. We ran out of space gas. Yeah, it's brutal. Kinda,
you know those, the old, from the original trilogy, how the Millennium Falcon had those kind of breakdown noises it would make? They should have done that in that movie. That would be
awesome. yeah. Just brutal. Yeah, so Star Wars is just not in a good place right now. And if they don't release, I think they're scheduled to release something by 2025. If they don't do something in the theater, people are just going to start forgetting about it. If it's only going to be comic books and, you know, streaming series, that's going to be rough. So we'll see. Well, this last piece is about cautious optimism, right? Right? So the last thing I wanted to talk about, and something that Matt has some familiarity with, Tunnels and Trolls, the second big RPG released very shortly after the original D&D, is returning with a new edition from a new studio. So Rebellion, the publisher of 2000 AD and also the Sniper Elite series, and a lot of other, they're doing a lot of board games and things recently as well in their Rebellion Unplugged. They bought the rights on the eve of the 50th anniversary of Tunnels and Trolls for the a new version of Tunnels and Trolls, as well as they're going to keep active, like, everything that's available right now. Because the interesting thing about it is it really hasn't changed that much. The rules are not very different from the 1975 original. So there hasn't been big changes. So if you're familiar with it at all, it still plays pretty much like it always has. So it's generally considered to be the second major tabletop RPG ever published, because things like Empire of the Petal Throne were self-published previously to that, so not officially distributed. So Ken St. Andre was the original creator, and basically Tunnels and Trolls was a reaction to him seeing Dungeons and Dragons and saying it's a little too complicated, and what's with these dice, let's just do d6s and have a little more playful, have a little bit more of a sense of humor. So 6-sided dice and 8 basic stats, including a luck stat, which is a very fun mechanic, and also points-based magic. So in comparison to what D&D was doing, it was a whole kind of a different take that let people that weren't quite, you know, didn't quite take to that original D&D rule set to jump onto something else and to play, you know, fantasy role play. The other great kind of innovation that they had is solo play. So they basically released lone player adventures that were solo adventures that basically I think were the inspiration to things like Fighting Fantasy and Choose Your Own Adventure books, because you're basically going through a numbered set of events that have mechanical, you know, you're keeping track, you're keeping a character sheet, but you're also progressing through this adventure similar to a Choose Your Own Adventure book. And that was a big early kind of innovation for tabletop, because D&D wasn't doing anything like that. I think eventually in the 80s, they did release their own kind of choose your own adventure books. But as far as solo play for D&D, that never was an official thing.
Yeah, Tunnels and Trolls is like, so the background there that you were talking about, mm-hmm. there's a cool story. Like, he basically went to like some kind of convention or something, mm-hmm. like super small scale, obviously, because it was the 70s,
but right.
saw D&D being played, couldn't actually afford it, and built a game from what he remembered seeing.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is totally cool. And I don't know, I don't know if you've ever played it, but the interaction is, even though it's a fantasy role-playing game, mm-hmm. it's so different.
Mm-hmm.
than how D&D and everything, most everything came after D&D works. Like, literally, like, it feels more like a co-op game, because, like, everything is a dice, right? Mm-hmm. You have mm-hmm. dice, and you just roll the dice for your weapons. You add the appropriate number, which might be, like, your strength or your dexterity. But everyone does it all at once.
Yes, yes, right.
You just come up with this big-ass number.
Right.
And you compare it to the bad guy's big-ass number.
Mm-hmm.
And the bigger number wins. And the losers take the difference in damage.
Mm-hmm.
And they get split it up however they want. And you just rinse and repeat until the combat is over.
Right.
And, like, it's so different than, like, anything mm-hmm. that's in the RPG scene, really. And I've always loved they're like an indie company. They never got out of indie mode,
mm-hmm.
you know. Like, they're kind of Steve Jackson-y, you know.
Right.
Nothing's high budget, flying under the radar. You mentioned the solo games is probably what kept them alive.
Yeah, yeah.
People love their solo. There's a ton of solo modules for Tunnels and Trolls,
mm-hmm.
and it's also such a simple system that it's really easy to homebrew. Kind of the way OSR people will look fondly at original D&D.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, it's so easy to do homebrew stuff with this because it's so simple. Well, Tunnel of the Troll is even simpler.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, and then, like you mentioned, the fun aesthetic. Like, if you go through their rule book, you know, there's line drawing cartoons all over the place, you know, mm-hmm. and they're just silly. Like, there's an ogre with an arrow through his head and he's yelling, "You missed all my vital spots," you know, and like,
Right.
You know, that kind of, and then spell names, you know, take that, you fiend is the fireball of Tunnels and Trolls, basically.
Mm-hmm.
They have a wall dissolving spell called Slush Yuck, you know, and like, yeah, just the whole aesthetic is fun and light and easy to get into. So I really hope this works out. Like,
yeah, me too.
And they don't alter it too much. It's a British company, right?
You said? So. Yeah, Rebellion, yeah.
Yeah, I hope they don't feel the need to alter it too much. It'd be cool if they, like, gave you like a new slate of optional rules to maybe make it a little more right or something.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
but keep the core.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the version history of Tunnels and Trolls is really interesting. So this article was saying that in the first 5 years, they did several new additions, but then almost for 30 years, nothing happened between the from the 1979 fifth edition. So from 1979 to about 2005, things kind of stayed the same. And fifth edition was the furthest that it went. Then it was a kind of 5.5 revision. A seventh edition was released that same year that 5.5 came out, kind of jumping jumping numbers. And the other thing that I thought was, and then there was a 30th anniversary that was kind of their 7.5 in 2008. The game's eighth edition, released in 2012, was exclusively released in French. I thought that was a great detail. And then, of course, 2015, we got the deluxe edition. So if you've bought Tunnels and Trolls recently, you probably have that deluxe edition book, which is effectively the ninth edition of the rules. But like I've always understood, that the rules didn't ever drastically change. It was always, you know, very much the same game. Things didn't go very far. So Flying Buffalo was the original publisher, and Rick Loomis passed away in 2019. So the rights of Tunnels and Trolls were then acquired by a conglomerate named Webbed Sphere. And we have had from Trollhalla, at least the press that that Ken St. Andre still works with, they have done still regular releases. We're getting a lot of things, mostly digital on DriveThruRPG and things, a lot of solo adventures and things are being brought back. But now we're going to see a new version now that Rebellion has picked it up. So a British publishing house, but also a video game developer and comic book publisher. So they do a lot of stuff. So Rebellion does 2000 AD. Their in-house tabletop studio is called Rebellion Unplugged. Prior to the pandemic, they were going to release these kind of RPG and a magazine scenarios that were coming out semi-regularly, but they only released the first one, pandemic hit, and they kind of things slowed down. A second one was finally released a few years later, and they do good quality production, like the production of their RPG works. And they're also reviving a lot of the old Judge Dredd board games and things. So they do decent production work. So it's going to look nice. It's going to have a good look to it. But this acquisition of the rights is also going to allow them to, they've acquired all of Flying Buffalo's games, so that it will include the City Book, the Fantasy Business Supplement, the Grimtooth series, Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes. So everything that was under the Flying Buffalo ownership, Rebellion will now be producing, and they'll keep it available. Everything that's already been produced will still be available in PDF version as it is now on DriveThru. But their plans are to release a new edition of Tunnels and Trolls, bringing the RPG into a new era, is the quote. And so that's a little bit worrisome, but still they're saying they are very early on in development. So hopefully they share with the community, or in playtesting or something, we get some exposure to this before it actually goes to press, so we can know whether or not, you know, we want to, whether this is going to be a faithful or a very strange updating of these rules.
Will that be the 10th edition?
Yeah, I guess it would officially be a 10th edition and a 50th anniversary edition too, because if they're the same, if they're saying 75, so yeah, 2025 would be the 50th anniversary of Tunnels and Trolls. So yeah, that would be a 10th edition on the 50th anniversary. So, yeah, very interesting. So Duncan Malloy, who is the studio head at Rebellion Unplugged, calls Tunnels and Trolls an unrecognized trailblazer in the games industry. So the team at Flying Buffalo responded early to an entirely new medium by focusing on how role-playing could be more approachable, more accessible, and more fun, Malloy says. He said, also, so much of the modern era of role-playing, from old-school hacks to streamlined systems to solo play, can directly trace its roots back to this series. We're very excited to channel that spirit and bring Tunnels and Trolls into a modern era. So yeah, so everything that was previously published will still be available in PDF forms as it is now, and they're working currently on a new edition. So I hope that it goes well. I think I have a I feel the same way about Tunnels and Trolls that I do kind of Dungeon Crawl Classics. It's such a kind of loving, you know, playful response to what's become kind of a more serious or more, you know, lifestyle brand of fantasy tabletop roleplay, that I think it's necessary for these things to exist and people to keep their sense of humor and their playfulness about how these games should run, instead of just, you know, min-maxing and, you know, power gaming as heroes. The fun of dungeon crawling and of this setting, I think Tunnels and Trolls has in spades.
The only difference is, like, Tunnels and Trolls from 1975 had more cohesive editing than Dungeon Crawl Classics does right now.
Well, that's true.
But anyway.
Right. But yeah, I hope they do this justice. I think if they really are fans of the original and don't put too much, you know, kind of Brit, you know, RPG aesthetic into it, the British touch, we don't need grim dark Tunnels and Trolls or anything like that, or too much political satire about politicians and systems we know nothing about.
It's like the original, well, not the original, but it was always rooted in homebrew worlds and homebrew games. Like, they had a world for it, but I don't think many people used it.
Right.
Like,
right.
It was always a do-it-yourself kind of game. So,
yeah. Yeah. And the one thing that I've read, that hopefully with a company that has some resources like Rebellion, one of the things that they can go after that I think really hurt Tunnels and Trolls, because they stayed very indie, you know, the Flying Buffalo stayed very indie in how they were producing it, is they can go after those people on Amazon that are basically doing print on demand bootleg versions of all of the solo adventures and everything that's been produced for Tunnels and Trolls. You can buy in these, like, paperback collections, and there's all of these unofficial versions that Flying Buffalo isn't able to go out and legally have taken down. So you've got so many people that are printing materials they didn't write, that they've just stolen. They've basically taken these PDFs and are making physical versions of them. And so the market gets very diluted and confused. If you search Tunnels and Trolls on something like Amazon, you get a lot of this weird bootleg stuff that it is the original material, but it's not benefiting any of the original creators. The original companies and designers are not seeing anything from it, because it's all basically pirated, you know, pirated digital goods made physical. So yeah, I hope Rebellion can clean that up a little bit and kind of get the brand, you know, rewarding the people that actually worked on it. But so it's fun. Yeah, I played a lot of the solo adventures. So I've done a few of solo campaigns, and that was something that I was even considering doing, like an actual play, solo play on the channel. When I reviewed, when I went through Tunnels and Trolls as a kind of a flip through book review, some people were saying, yeah, they would want to see that on the channel. So I'm still tempted. I'm still tempted to do that. But
so when you did the solo games or the flip through, I guess, either one, was that your first exposure to Tunnels and Trolls?
Yes. Or did you yes, it was. Okay. Yeah, I didn't. Yeah. Back in the day, I didn't. I don't think, because I basically had one hobby shop. And so whatever he carried was the stuff we played. So he was, like, heavy into Palladium and TSR, basically. Yeah. So there was a lot of stuff that I wasn't exposed to. And no Games Workshop, no Citadel stuff at all. Yeah.
So I always wonder where people come down on, like, this kind of thing. Because I think, for me, when I see, like, that sort of primitive cartoony art. Mm-hmm. And then there's also, their biggest artist was Liz Danforth.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And even, but back then, even maybe she hadn't completely fleshed out her skills. I don't know how you describe that, but so there's some stuff in there that Watsy wouldn't put on their books. Let's put it that way.
Right, right.
And I'm always curious, like, when you saw that for the first time, were you like, oh, this is amateurish, or was it more like a sentimental, oh, this is old and, you know, cute or something? I mean, what was your reaction?
Oh yeah, no, the art, I like the art for Tunnels and Trolls a lot. Yeah, and it had some nostalgia to it, because I think, you know, all of the early, you know, early TSR stuff and everything, it was rough, like the line art and stuff. Even there were some talented artists, but most of them hadn't quite hit their stride yet about, like, you know, hit a really solid style. So no, I liked it a lot of that. It was very charming and felt appropriate. You know, I liked it. I think it worked well with the setting and the fact that it was an older game. Yeah, I didn't think it worked well.
That's always my feeling as well. But if I think, like, between Wizards and Games Workshop, there's a whole segment of gamers now that they expect this, like, just intricate, glossy art that's, like, super detailed but in an unrealistic, heroic way. And I just wonder how they will react if this company even tries to stick with that, or they just bring in all new art. I don't know.
I wonder. Yeah, that's right. If they try to recreate. Yeah. Yeah, I wonder what Rebellion's choices are going to be. Their stuff is pretty, I mean, they're reprinting a lot of older stuff. So some of the art is kind of wonky, and like the Judge Dredd board games and stuff. It's not amazingly, like, it's not very digital or very modern. So I wonder, yeah, what they're going to go with for the aesthetic. Yeah, because they could definitely take it the wrong direction. If they make it look too slick, I think people will not quite understand, what they're dealing with as far as the system. Because there is a certain, because like the naming conventions for the spells and things, I think there is an aesthetic that fits that. And it's definitely not that, very epic, digitally painted, dynamic art that Wizards of the Coast uses for D&D. So we don't want to see that. So yeah, I wonder. Yeah, but we'll see. I definitely want to keep an eye on this, because I would love to see a new edition of this and see support for this that was more focused and got people to see this as a very viable alternative to Dungeons and Dragons. And we were talking about wanting to move away from 5e. This would be a great way. I mean, 10e Tunnels and Trolls would be a great way to replace that replace that system.
I think they had multi-classing before D&D did too.
Oh wow.
Cuz they had the wizard warrior option right out of in the first edition.
Very cool. Yeah, so what was your experience? So this was the first fantasy roleplay game that you played?
Yeah. Dungeons and Trolls? Yeah. Yeah. So when I was like 14, I fell in with these high school guys who were playing role-playing games regularly, and they were running Tunnels and Trolls and Star Frontiers.
Oh, wow.
Like, I owned some D&D stuff. Like, I owned the Monster Manual and the old Red Box, the old basic Red Box, not the other, newer one.
Right.
And but I never played them. I just kind of flipped through them. Like, it's hilarious. You reading the Monster Manual and trying to understand how a game works, when you're a kid,
Right.
So the first real game I played was Tunnels and Trolls, and then we played Star Frontiers. So then when D&D actually rolled around, D&D felt like so different, Like,
right.
Because even Star Frontiers, although it was a TSR product, the system was completely different than D&D. It was more of a percentile game.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, I've always had like an old school perspective, but slightly askew because I started in a different place than a lot of people did.
Interesting. Yeah, that's very cool. Nice. So, are you optimistic about what Rebellion could do, or do you think it's
hopeful?
Yeah, hopeful.
I mean, if they got 2008, I like 2000 AD, I used to play some of those old Judge Dredd games. And so if they stuck with the vintage on those, then we're probably in a good place.
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah. And if it's more, and if they are going to consider the 50th anniversary and stuff, they are going to want to make sure it's a recognizable version of the game. So yeah, that would be very cool. So
if I were them, I'd give her the core book and then the, and here's some cool stuff you could try book, it's like a 2-book set or something.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, so we will definitely be paying attention, and hopefully they'll be releasing stuff to the public, and so we'll get a chance to see what they want to do with it before, something just goes to press. So yeah, interesting. 50 years of Tunnels and Trolls will now be finished off in England. Wow. All right. So that is going to do it for this week. So where can people find you, Matt? Do you want to promote anything?
I'm on Twitter. Elon Musk announced that he's finally stepping down.
He was voted off, right, on his Twitter poll?
No, yeah, but he refused to acknowledge that in the jacket. Anyway, so I'm on there. It's at Hargald, H-A-A-R-G-A-L-D. Exact same thing on Tribal, if you want to be one of the four people talking about games on Tribal. Or Instagram. I occasionally post my Stargrave pictures on Instagram. Yeah, that's me.
Okay, cool.
How about you?
All right, and I'm still doing my single panel gag cartoon. So Abuse Cartoons on Twitch and YouTube. You can find that. So I draw the cartoon, eat some crazy stuff from Japanese convenience stores, and it's just basically a hang, and gives me a couple hours to get my ideas drawn out, and also it's fun. I get a lot of feedback and stuff from the chat, so it helps a lot to make sure I'm not trying to make some totally incomprehensible joke that nobody's going to get, some pop culture reference that nobody knows anything about anymore. But yeah, so Abuse Cartoons. And if you want to read the cartoon, gocomics.com/domesticabuse is the archive. So 20 years of that cartoon.
That's huge, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of it. And if you want to support what we're doing at Upturned Table, please visit the website first of all. So everything is there. And Upturned Table on social media, and to become a weekling, a direct supporter of the weekly live stream and podcast, please visit patreon.com/upturntable. And we have got a bunch of different pledge levels to support kind of what's going on here. And the latest thing that we posted was the Dragonbane. So Dragonbane actual play, the first episode of that came out. And yeah, so it was a little different from our Blade Runner, because we were actually using tokens and a grid for that. So, but the art assets are so good from Free League that it still has a nice feel. There's still enough of a story there. It's not too much, you know, too much mechanics and too much, you know, dungeon crawling that you can't enjoy the story. And again, Matt knocked it out of the park with his Mallard Knight. There were some great, already in just episode one, some really great moments of of Duck Knight arrogance. Yeah, good stuff.
That was fun. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I can't wait. So that's we should have that relatively soon, right? The Dragonbane is on its way. And,
Yeah.
And you can also pick up, so that quick start that we used is free, is available for free on DriveThruRPG, and also the core set that includes everything that's going to be released when they fulfill the Kickstarter is already available digitally on DriveThruRPG. So those links are in the description. And that'll do it for this week. So Matt and I will be right back to talk about the chat, but give us about 30 seconds to get some room tone so we can clean up this audio. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back again next week. And thanks again to Matt for co-hosting. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.